Les colloques du Collège de France.
Monsieur le Président, cher Mario Draghi, Mesdames, Messieurs les ministres, Mesdames, Messieurs les ambassadeurs, représentants du corps diplomatique, Mesdames, Messieurs les parlementaires, Monsieur le gouverneur de la Banque de France, Madame la rectrice déléguée pour l'enseignement supérieur, la recherche et l'innovation, Mesdames, Messieurs les présidents d'établissements, Mesdames, Messieurs en vos titres et fonctions, Mesdames, Messieurs les professeurs, chers collègues, cher Philippe, Mesdames, Messieurs, c'est un plaisir et un honneur de vous accueillir ici au Collège de France pour cette manifestation exceptionnelle. Mais permettez-moi, avant de commencer ce tout petit discours d'accueil, d'exprimer en ce 13 novembre toutes nos sympathies et nos pensées pour les victimes de l'attentat du Bataclan, il y a 9 ans déjà. Je me réjouis de voir cet amphithéâtre Marguerite Navarre rempli, ce qui témoigne de l'intérêt du public pour les enjeux européens et pour l'économie. Et je me félicite particulièrement de l'initiative de Philippe Aguillon, et je le remercie au nom de tous nos collègues pour ce colloque et la table ronde qui suivra. Il faut y voir, dans cette manifestation, la convergence entre, d'une part, les champs de recherche poursuivis depuis des années par Philippe Aguillon autour de l'innovation et de la croissance, et l'événement qui a constitué la publication de votre rapport, cher Mario Draghi, en septembre, dans un contexte où les tensions géopolitiques et la concurrence économique ne cessent de s'accroître et où l'Europe doit à nouveau faire face à des défis renouvelés. Après 3 décennies de rattrapage de l'Europe occidentale par rapport aux États-Unis après la Seconde Guerre mondiale, cette tendance s'est inversée depuis le milieu des années 90, la plupart des innovations étant réalisées aux États-Unis et non en Europe. Pour enrayer cette tendance, Mario Draghi a élaboré un plan visionnaire qui propose des investissements publics et privés massives dans la recherche fondamentale et les technologies de rupture, ainsi que des réformes de la gouvernance de l'Union européenne visant à rationaliser le processus décisionnel, à assouplir les contraintes réglementaires et à confier les rênes aux scientifiques et aux entrepreneurs. Donc l'objectif de cette rencontre est de faire la lumière sur les sources du déclin technologique de l'Europe, mais on ne va pas rester négatif, mais aussi on va parler des remèdes possibles. Il s'agit également d'identifier des politiques et des stratégies pour surmonter les multiples obstacles, pour donner à l'Europe les moyens de retrouver sa compétitivité. Alors, vous pouvez vous demander pourquoi ça a lieu ici au Collège de France. C'est tout à fait normal que ces débats soient accueillis ici. Le Collège de France, je le dis à l'intention d'un peu tout le monde, mais aussi de l'HCRS, c'est une institution singulière dont le 500e anniversaire approche d'ici quelques ans, 2030. Nous ne sommes ni une université, ni un organisme de recherche, mais le Collège de France se trouve au croisement entre enseignement, recherche et diffusion des savoirs. En effet, le Collège de France, c'est un lieu d'enseignement pluridisciplinaire, unique au monde, grâce à ses 46 professeurs sur chaire statuaires cette année et 6 professeurs sur chaire annuelle, ça fait à peu près 1000 cours, des conférences, d'autres événements par les meilleurs spécialistes. Tous nos enseignements sont totalement gratuits et accessibles au public, ici dans les amphis, mais aussi via YouTube et d'autres moyens. Donc nous avons plus que 3 millions de visionnages sur YouTube. Mais peut-être aussi ce qui est moins connu au courant public, le Collège de France est un acteur de premier plan de la recherche française, hébergeant plus de 400 chercheurs, s'appuyant sur 8 instituts disciplinaires auxquels sont affiliés 21 laboratoires et d'équipes de recherche, et qui joue également un rôle très actif en matière de formation doctorale. Permettez-moi aussi de rappeler que le Collège de France entend prendre sa part dans la réflexion sur les enjeux européens. Je ne vais pas faire l'historique du Collège, on n'a pas le temps, mais dès les premiers électeurs royaux, en 1530, il y a eu déjà des Européens. Parmi les premiers électeurs royaux, il y avait des Italiens, des Wallons et d'autres. Ce n'est pas encore les pays tels qu'on les connaît, mais c'était déjà cette ouverture vers l'Europe. Et cette ouverture vers l'Europe s'est poursuivie par les travaux des professeurs, notamment sur l'histoire longue du continent depuis la Grèce antique, mais aussi sur l'évolution du droit, sur les migrations, sur les questions de santé publique en donnant la parole à de nombreux chercheurs européens de premier plan. Le Collège de France poursuit sa réflexion sur l'Europe aussi à l'occasion d'événements exceptionnels, la Nuit européenne des idées, le cycle Europe du Collège de France, mais aussi la chaire annuelle, l'invention de l'Europe par les langues et les cultures, en partenariat avec le ministère de la Culture. Et je suis très heureux que Roselyne Bachelot est là, puisque c'est avec elle que cette aventure a commencé. Je forme le vœu que cet événement puisse à la fois vous donner envie de revenir au Collège de France et qu'il soit aussi l'amorce d'autres événements d'enjeux européens, car le Collège de France est aussi le Collège d'Europe. Pour la table ronde qui va commencer à 15h30, nous aurons le plaisir et l'honneur d'accueillir M. Emmanuel Macron, président de la République, dans un échange avec vous, cher Mario Draghi, et animé par notre collègue Philippe Aguillon. Enfin, avant de céder la parole à Philippe, qui va introduire les travaux de cet après-midi et vous présenter les premiers invités, que je remercie vivement de leur présence, un petit rappel en termes d'organisation. Je vous rappelle que tous les téléphones portables ont un bouton qui s'appelle « éteindre ». Et ensuite, à la fin de cet après-midi, pour la fin de la séance, je vous prie de bien vouloir attendre le départ du président de la République pour quitter ensuite la salle. Merci beaucoup et je donne la parole à Philippe.
Je vais faire ma présentation en français, en fait, voilà. Mais les autres présentations seront en anglais. Donc voilà, donc en fait, le pourquoi du rapport, je crois que c'est le constat qu'il y a que l'Europe est en phase de déclin technologique par rapport aux États-Unis, notamment. Donc là, je vous montre un diagramme qui sera présenté également par Antonin, qui est dû à Antonin. Et ce que ce diagramme montre, c'est le PIB par tête de la zone euro par rapport au PIB par tête américain. Vous voyez que ça baisse beaucoup. Évidemment, là, il y a la Deuxième Guerre mondiale qui fait chuter ce PIB par tête européen par rapport au PIB par tête américain. Et ensuite, vous voyez qu'il y a une phase de rattrapage jusque dans le milieu des années 90, début-milieu des années 90. Et ensuite, à nouveau, il y a un déclin européen par rapport aux États-Unis. Et Antonin va nous expliquer le pourquoi, qu'est-ce qu'il y a derrière ce déclin. Oui, je ne dois pas m'éloigner du micro. Toujours mon problème, c'est que je bouge beaucoup. Alors, pas mettre d'équation, c'est la seule que je mets. Mais ce que je veux dire ici, c'est qu'en fait, il y a deux façons de faire de la croissance de la productivité. Une manière, c'est de rattraper la frontière technologique, c'est de faire de la croissance de rattrapage. Une autre façon, c'est que je suis déjà à la frontière et je produis de la croissance de la productivité en innovant sur moi-même, en innovant à la frontière. Et les politiques qui sont bonnes pour le rattrapage ne sont pas les mêmes politiques que celles qui sont bonnes pour la croissance à la frontière. Si maintenant on revient à la comparaison entre l'Europe et les États-Unis, en fait, ce qui s'est passé, c'est que pendant la phase de rattrapage de l'Europe, en fait, pourquoi l'Europe a rattrapé pendant les 30 glorieuses, entre la fin de la guerre et enfin, un peu plus, et jusque fin des années 80, c'est parce qu'en fait, on avait d'abord, il fallait reconstituer nos stocks de capital, donc on a pu reconstituer nos stocks de capital. Le plan Marshall a aidé, évidemment, et le prix de l'énergie faible. Et par ailleurs, on a imité des technologies, alors on a innové, mais on a imité beaucoup de technologies venant des États-Unis notamment, grâce au niveau éducatif que nous avions chez nous. Nous avions la possibilité donc de rattraper par la reconstitution de notre stock de capital et l'adoption de l'imitation de technologies venant des États-Unis. Alors maintenant, évidemment, on est dans un stade où on a rattrapé largement et on doit passer on doit maintenant innover à la frontière. Mais ce qui s'est passé, c'est qu'on n'a pas su adapter nos institutions d'institutions qui favorisent le rattrapage à des institutions qui favorisent l'innovation de rupture, la croissance à la frontière. Et juste, ça s'est passé juste au moment où est arrivée la révolution des technologies de l'information venant des États-Unis. Les États-Unis ont su monter tout de suite dans ce train-là, et nous sommes montrés très tard et incomplètement dans le train de la révolution d'éthique. Et le danger, c'est qu'il se passe la même chose à nouveau avec l'IA, c'est-à-dire qu'on met trop de temps à monter dans le train de l'IA. Alors, un bon système, un bon écosystème d'innovation, je ne veux pas rester trop long, je regarde la montre, puisque je suis censé discipliner tout le monde, et donc je veux que je m'impose la discipline à moi-même. On ne fait pas de bon, pour innover à la frontière, on ne le fait pas si on n'a pas un système de recherche fondamentale bien financé et bien gouverné. On ne le fait pas si on n'a pas un écosystème financier adéquat. Et on ne le fait pas si on n'a pas également des politiques, une bonne combinaison entre politique de concurrence et politique industrielle dans des domaines clés. Il faut ces ingrédients-là, quoi. Voilà. Alors, je ne veux pas passer trop longtemps. Qu'est-ce que ça veut dire aux États-Unis? Ils ont d'abord des universités très bien financées. Ils ont des agences comme la National Science Foundation et la National Institute of Health, dont on a l'ANR, mais ils ont également des fondations privées comme la Howard Hughes Medical Investigator qui financent des chercheurs sur le long terme. Nous n'avons rien en France, par exemple, et en Europe, quasiment rien pour financer des chercheurs sur le long terme. Donc, ils ont tout un écosystème pour favoriser la recherche fondamentale. D'accord ? Et puis, donc par exemple, ça c'est le Howard Hughes Medical Investigator. On compare ici des chercheurs qui reçoivent un financement de la Howard Hughes Medical Investigator à des chercheurs de niveau comparable qui n'ont pas reçu de financement. Et on voit que les publications, et notamment les publications dans les meilleures revues scientifiques, eh bien, est stimulée par le fait de recevoir un financement de la HHMI. Nous n'avons rien comme le HHMI en Europe et en France en particulier. Alors la deuxième chose, c'est l'écosystème financier. L'innovation à la frontière, c'est très bien d'avoir du financement bancaire, mais c'est aussi important, encore plus important, d'avoir du capital risque et des investisseurs institutionnels. Par exemple, aux États-Unis, on sait que les capital risqueurs, eh bien, ils sélectionnent typiquement les innovations, les gens qui produisent beaucoup de brevets. Donc ça, c'est on regarde ceux qui reçoivent qui ont la plus grande probabilité de recevoir des financements de capital risqueurs aux États-Unis. C'est également les gens qui sont au quantile supérieur en termes de nombre de brevets. C'est-à-dire que les venture capitalistes américains sont très bons à sélectionner des gens qui innovent plus. Mais non seulement ils les sélectionnent bien, mais à qualité égale, une fois qu'ils les ont financés, eh bien, ça donne un boost, ça stimule la production d'innovation, vous voyez, de brevets par ces entreprises. Donc, vous voyez, le capital risque, c'est très important. Mais nous, il est très peu développé en Europe, d'accord, par rapport aux États-Unis. Et puis, il y a ce qu'on appelle les investisseurs institutionnels, c'est-à-dire les fonds de pension, les fonds de retraite. Eh bien, nous, évidemment, en partie parce qu'on a un système de répartition et pas un système par capitalisation, encore que d'autres pays en ont, on a des investisseurs institutionnels beaucoup moins développés qu'aux États-Unis. Or, ils stimulent beaucoup l'innovation, notamment dans les grandes entreprises. Et là, c'est simplement, je ne veux pas vous regarder les chiffres, mais ça montre que plus vous avez un investisseur institutionnel qui a des parts importantes dans des grandes entreprises américaines, plus ces entreprises sont innovantes. Et on montre que l'effet est causal avec mes collègues Vandrinon et Zingales. Voilà, donc vous voyez, ça, cet écosystème-là financier, eh bien, on ne l'a pas du tout en Europe comme on l'a aux États-Unis. Et finalement, il y a les politiques industrielles, notamment le modèle ARPA, et comment réconcilier politique industrielle. Nous, très souvent, au nom de la politique de concurrence en Europe, on a dit pas d'aide sectorielle d'État, et on est très anti-politique industrielle. Or, là, il va falloir de la politique industrielle, mais qui soit pro-concurrence, réconciliée avec la politique de concurrence. Voilà. Donc, qu'est-ce qu'il faut pour nous mettre aux standards américains, aux meilleurs standards mondiaux? Il nous faut d'abord un vrai marché unique pour les biens et services, et Mario explique en quoi nous sommes très loin encore du marché unique, et on a beaucoup à faire, parce qu'un innovateur en Europe doit pouvoir vendre partout, et ça permet d'abord d'avoir plus de valeur pour l'innovation que vous faites, plus de récompenses, et en même temps, ça stimule la concurrence. Donc, le marché unique, c'est très important, et nous sommes loin encore du marché unique. Deux, il faut un marché du capital intégré, avec beaucoup plus d'importance, en donnant beaucoup plus, mettant l'accent beaucoup plus sur financement par action, equity financing, venture capital, investisseurs institutionnels, plutôt que uniquement financement bancaire. Et puis, il faut repenser complètement la politique d'innovation européenne, partant de la recherche fondamentale jusqu'à la politique industrielle, les DARPA. Nous n'avons rien en Europe qui s'apparente de près ou de loin à des DARPA. D'accord ? Alors, en gros, pour terminer, le grand problème de l'Europe, c'est qu'on est un géant réglementaire et un nain budgétaire. Nous sommes très hayekiens. Et il faut, vous voyez, on a les trois piliers de la politique européenne économique. Le pacte de stabilité, c'est très bien, mais on met sur le même plan des dépenses de fonctionnement et des dépenses de croissance. Il faut qu'on distingue entre les deux. On a une politique de concurrence au nom de laquelle on empêche la politique industrielle. Il faut au contraire que ce soit une politique de concurrence qui accommode la politique industrielle et qui pousse pour une politique industrielle compatible avec la politique de la concurrence. Et le budget européen, c'est 1% du PIB. Il faut permettre des possibilités d'emprunt européen. Et donc, voilà. Donc, si vous voulez juste dire là, il y a un agenda énorme. C'est un rapport révolutionnaire qu'a produit Mario Draghi. Et donc, c'est un honneur, Mario, de vous avoir avec nous aujourd'hui. Je passe la parole à le deuxième intervenant. Merci beaucoup. Antonin.
So, thank you. I'm going to speak in English because the slides are in English. So this is a quick summary of a paper I presented at Sintra this summer. It's about the history and the future of European productivity, and I think it resonates very well with Mario Draghi's report. I'm going to show you very briefly part of the results. So first, Philippe showed that already, but just so that you have the figure in mind again, this is the relative GDP per capita in Europe as opposed to the US. And the goal is that you can see that from mid-1980s, there is a widening gap between Europe and GDP in terms of Europe and the US in terms of GDP per capita, but we can go a little bit further with the data, and we can in fact decompose this gap into few parts that explain exactly the trade-off that we face in Europe. So if you look at the very right part of the graph, what you can see is that so GDP per capita is the product of labor productivity and labor utilization. And if you want GDP per capita in Europe to be catching up with the level of the US, you need more productivity. And the reason for that is that if you look at the green and blue areas, they are negative, meaning that Europe has a strong preference for leisure compared to the US. We work less than Americans. And the issue is that without TFP, without productivity, this also means that we will have less GDP per capita. So this graph is a little bit complicated, but what it shows is that it's important for us Europeans to think about our productivity because we clearly work less than Americans. And as a result, we have a lower GDP per capita. We can look then at the trend in labor productivity, and they are actually even more dramatic than what we see for GDP per capita. This is labor productivity. This is the amounts of value added that are created with 1 hour of work in Europe, in the euro area to be exact, and in the US. And you see that in 1995, the levels are quite similar. They are around 45, 50 euros. And it has been, you know, diverging since then. And nowadays, the level is about, you know, close to half what we have in the US. There's many debate as whether, you know, those numbers could be actually compared. But even if you focus only on Europe, if you only focus on the euro area, something that is quite striking is that the trend of labor productivity after the pandemics has declined quite significantly. Or the labor productivity has deviated from its trend. And the trend was already negative compared to the US. So we already grew lower and slower than the US. And since the pandemic, this has gotten much worse. So the question is, what happened around the 1980s, 1990s? This is where we started to diverge with the US. And one thing that we can see from the data already is that it's mostly explained by sectors that use IT or produce IT more than others. So if you split the economy into two categories of sectors, those that are intensive in IT and the other one, and you look at the labor productivity in those sectors, what you see is that, and these are the solid lines, what you see is that above median sectors in terms of IT usage is where the divergence is the most striking. And labor productivity was multiplied by about 2 in the US in those sectors, and in Europe it's only an increase of 30%. In the rest of the economy, there is still a slight divergence, as you can see, but nothing completely dramatic. Most of the effect comes from sectors that use IT more. So why is that? Philippe mentioned industrial policy, and Philippe explained what were the engine of growth before the 1990s. And I think they were not efficient enough to have Europe as a whole or European countries succeed in doing the transition toward this new wave of technology that arrived, which is IT. One of the reasons is that clearly we don't invest enough in R&D. This is R&D expenditures in 4 important regions, Europe, Japan, US, and China. And you see that Europe is clearly behind Japan and the US. And as is now well known, this is not an issue of public expenditures. Actually, R&D spending by the public sectors are about the same in Europe and in the US. It's a bit less than 1% of GDP. The main question is why this 1% of GDP that is invested by public institutions and public sectors in Europe do not generate more R&D expenditures in the private sectors. And essentially, the question is that this is mostly an issue of the allocation and the way these spendings are invested in the economy. And you know, it would take a lot of time to discuss innovation policy and industrial policies in Europe, but essentially this ended up with what the Fuest et al. Report called the middle technology trap. There's not enough entry, there's not enough renewed of the innovative actors. You can see it very clearly when you look at the top patenting firms in Europe and in the US. In 2005, you can see that those are the five most innovative firms in terms of patent filing in the US and in Europe. These are essentially, you know, comparable firms, manufacturing firms. If you look at the same ranking in 2023, in Europe, you see the exact same firms. In the US, you see firms that are mostly in the digital sectors, and some of them you know, were very, very young in 2005. So there is not enough entry, not enough competition, at least when you look at the top innovative firm in Europe, and there is no transition in terms of who are doing innovation, which firm are doing the most innovation, toward more digital sectors. We can look even more micro. You know, this is looking at a very specific type of patent. This is patents filed in computer vision, which is arguably a very important high tech, especially for the AI revolution. If you look at who originated the patents in this technology, you can see that at the beginning of the 2000, this was pretty much, you know, one third in Europe, and most of them were already in the US, a little bit in Japan. And as we go through, we go through 2019, which is the last data point, you can see that the rise of China essentially was done at the expense of Japan and the euro area. And today, most of the production in computer vision is done in China and in the US. The same can be done if you look at AI patents. Euro area filed on average 450 patents in AI a year. That's about a third of what is done in the US and half of what is done in China. So we are not producing enough of the technologies that are high tech and that are the ones that are probably going to help us take up the next productivity wave that is already probably happening. But there are some things that are specific to Europe, and that's a bit of a silver lining. First, Europe has the talent to produce knowledge and frontier knowledge. In fact, if you look at who were the researchers that created the knowledge that were used in those patents in computer visions that are essentially filed in the US and China, there are about 30% of those researchers that work in Europe. So, and it's to generate a bit less than 10% of the patent. So there is a lot of the knowledge that is used by American firm and by Chinese firm that is generated in Europe universities. And the same applies with AI. If you look at the origin of AI academic paper, the really basic of the research that created those, you know, large language models or those AI products that we use, a lot of this is done in Europe. If you pile up all the orange areas, you get to exactly the same level as in the US. And that's weighted by citation. And that includes papers that were used by Google and OpenAI to create Transformers and OpenAI. So in Europe, we have the talent, we have the ability to create knowledge. What's missing is that it doesn't translate to commercializable technology that are produced by European firms. We are also leading in green technology. If you look at green patents, Europe produces a lot of green patents, actually just at the same level as China, but much more than in the US. And finally, Europe has also some from regions that are extremely productive. In orange here, you see regions that are more productive than the average American region, that the average productivity in the US. So as you can see, most of them are either in Switzerland, Austria, or Netherlands and Belgium. But there are some regions in Europe that are extremely productive. If you look at total factor productivity and how it developed over the past 70 years, you can see that some countries in Europe are actually not far away from the level of the US. Netherlands, Austria, Sweden, those are countries that invest a lot in R&D. Those are countries that manage to create some kind of ecosystem that make them productive and allow them to some extent compete in terms of productivity with the US. So what can be done? And that will be my last slide. I think it's quite clear that you know, Europe has a lot of leakage that goes to the US. We are losing investment, especially investments that are going to high-tech firms. And that's clearly because high-tech firms are way more profitable in the US than in Europe. So why would European investors invest in European firms? They will go directly to the US. We are losing skilled workers to the US. We are losing entrepreneurs to the US. And we are also losing good ideas that are produced in European universities that are used by American firms. I think we should, you know, think about building policies that are consistent with our European characteristics, as opposed to trying to make us behaving exactly like Americans. One clear thing that we can see from what happened in Europe is that we have good researchers, we have good laboratories, and we have research that is at the frontier. So we should design R&D policies that are, you know, incentivize more collaboration between the private and the public sectors. I've worked on an example in France called the LabEx. This is a program that has been implemented in 2010. And this is, you know, a program that incentivized public laboratories to collaborate with private firms in exchange for some direct subsidies. And it worked very well. Like, if you look at the output in terms of patenting, in terms of R&D expenditures, you can see that firms started to collaborate more with researchers, and that generated new ideas at a cost that is much lower than those, you know, horizontal subsidies that are used in most European countries to try to push firms to innovate more. So I think we should focus more on targeted policies that will use this vehicle of pushing collaboration between public labs and private firms. The second thing is that some European regions are productive. And there is, I think, a trade-off between the way we think about the role of Europe in trying to design those spatial cohesion policy and try to send fundings to the less productive and the less developed areas in Europe, as opposed to building a strategy that would be efficient in terms of developing the new technologies that probably involve redirecting part of these fundings towards the more productive regions. And that's, you know, I'm not so sure that we can do both. So at some point, I think we should open the debate of whether we want to develop, to be at the frontier, to create a new Silicon Valley, or to create an Airbus of battery. And that probably means that we need to redirect a lot of investment to Netherlands, to Belgium, to Austria, which are the more productive area. And the last thing is that Europeans are clearly risk adverse if we look at, you know, the profile of our investment. And so probably we should reinforce to some extent public investment banking or public investors that will create new ways of financing high-tech firms that are probably more in line with risk aversion that is at play in Europe. And my last point was about AI. Not going to be too long on AI, but there's, you know, maybe a big opportunity with AI, because we know AI is very likely to generate huge productivity gains. Pricing, and that's in line a bit with papers that have been done at Collège de France by Philippe in particular, if we just use AI as a tool, like existing AI product as a tool to automate some of our tasks, and if we just, you know, take off-the-shelf products that are very easy to adopt, the gains in terms of productivity are going to be, you know, existing but not substantial. Maybe 1%, 2% in the next 10 years, that's not enough to be comparable to previous technological wave that we experience in Europe or in the US. And I think that if we want to benefit the most from the gains from AI, we need to be at the frontiers also in terms of producing those new products that will be more tailored to European needs, to European regulation, and to exactly the type of usage that European firms will need to do with AI. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Antonin. So next is Dietmar. Dietmar Harhoff is a professor at the Max Planck Institute for Innovation and Competition in Munich. And the floor is yours, Dietmar. And you pioneered the German DARPAs, no?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So despite of coming from a no-growth, no-government country, the fact... The fact that we were able to install something that does something that EIC certainly will do, successfully do, entitles me to say, hey, there's a message of hope here. We can do this. We can get agencies off the ground, agencies off the beaten path, that are agile, and that can do what Mario Draghi and his team told us, to focus on radical disruptive innovation, to get it going, to put it in the hands of not necessarily bureaucrats, but people who know the innovation business, and to incite a dynamic that will carry us, Europe, forward. And that's what I want to talk about. So it's organizing for disruptive. So essentially, I'm not here as the researcher. I also write papers, but right now I'm sort of a little bit in the implementation low country, if you want, and I'll tell you a story about that. So before I do that, let me pay respect to what Mario Draghi and his team have done, because it is wonderful that you have put the challenges that are that Europe is facing right in front of us in plain language. You have composed, you have collected, of course, stuff that is there, but you have added and you have put it, you have synthesized it into a framework that we can now discuss and apply. And that is wonderful. And you've put innovation smack in the middle of that. That is, I think, very encouraging for the people who have carried innovation forward in the past in Europe and who want to do more. And I'll talk a little bit about energizing that community as well, because that's an important part of what we need to do. So we need to work culturally as well as just pouring out money. We need to get our inventors and our thinkers and our scientists moving again. So I will not go into all of these, because each of these bullets is a lot of work. So you also have put in front of us a work package, right? So just think about reforming the EU's framework program from something where a lot of tiny, tiny questions are given to researchers who can then apply to answering those tiny, tiny questions into something that is grander, that is bigger, that allows for more freedom. Okay, researchers very much respond positively to that, okay? But it's a huge task. Increase the share of budget for disruptive innovation. The EIC now has a nice and sizable budget, but they will need more in order to come up with radical innovation at the European level and to implement it and to bring startups to the fore and establish new industries. And picking the right people, that will be my main message to you, is one of the most important things that we need to do. This is not about institutional design. This is about bringing the right people into the responsibility that they should have to tackle these tasks. Personality measures, leadership skills matter. So, and I have great respect for bureaucracy. I'm an ardent reader of Weber, okay? So fine, we need bureaucracy. But right now we need deviation from bureaucracy, we need radical changes, we need institutions off the beaten staff. So, make the transition from invention to commercialization easier again. Improve management of IP at university. I'll say briefly something, because the German agency picked a fight with university presidents who wanted to get rich by asking lots of licensing fees from their startups. Doesn't work. It deters the investors, okay? But you need to understand that. You need to be, you don't get rich by being greedy as a university president. And they need to understand that. Adopt a unitary patent, wonderful, again, okay? That's making progress, and that is helping startups. Lower the regulatory burden on SMEs, again, maybe a little bit easier said than done, but we're making progress on that as well. And then the final one, which I think is a wonderful example why gilded plating in the European context is wrong, establish one new legal form for startups. We had that on the table in Europe in 2013. It was killed by Germany. Why? Because the proposal that was on the table did not quite ascend to the sort of ambitions that we had with respect to worker representation. So we wanted to have the golden plated version of it, and that killed European collaboration. That cannot be. We need to find practical solutions. One such practical solution is an agency that's got off the ground in Germany, and that now creates a little bit of a conundrum. And the conundrum has to do with the fact that, as Mari Raghi and his team correctly observe, 90% of R&D is by nation states in Europe. The American picture is exactly the opposite, right? Only 10% comes from the states and 90% comes from the federal. So we have an imbalance here. We work with different models and we have to think about that. This is the history of the agency of Sprint, Agency for Radical Innovation, or for LEAP Innovation in Germany. It starts in 2016 in a discussion circle I was privy to attend around Angela Merkel. And she is the single most important actor in this because she pushed it against bureaucratic resistance in the ministries who saw this as competition. And I think we have to be aware of that, that all of these proposals will fall into political battles. And we have to back them up because they are important, okay? I will not go through all of that. There are papers, there's video conferences, there are coalition agreements and so forth. So finally, we are in the position of selecting a person to guide and lead this very unusual entrepreneur no academic training, dropped out after 4 weeks of his computer science studies in order to start his fifth company at the age of 18, right? So somebody with a deep technical understanding and very, very entrepreneurial. And by the way, a wonderful scientific understanding as well. It was put in a place in Leipzig, far enough away from Berlin so that it could work in peace. Okay? No implications mentioned by me here, okay? So the founding date of Sprint was the 1st of January of 2020, and it started. It turned out that it had been set up in the wrong way. We needed a correction. Now, it was an inventive team. They started to use tools that were around, for example, pre-commercial procurement, which the European Commission had set out as something that would entitle, people to do something agile, right? They found a new funding mechanism, validation projects. They became partners of a sovereign tech fund, and so forth. And then on January 1st of this year, German Bundestag passed, you have to give it to them, this is a wonderful name, the Sprint Liberation Law, Sprint Befreiungsgesetz. By the way, all parties agreed to it, and even the wing parties, left and right, did not vote against it. So there was a great support for doing what Sprint does. And it can now do VC-type funding. It can essentially do things that the EIC can do, albeit at a smaller scale, with about 220 million per annum. I think that the budget will go up to 500 within the next 3 or 4 years because they're doing great work. So I'm partial. I'm a member of the supervisory board, and obviously it's close to my heart. So these are the challenges that Sprint undertook. The challenges are tournaments, and there's a lot of economic tournament theory going into this, into the shaping of what it is. It's essentially the belief that we should not bet on individual companies, we should bet on a race, not on the horse. So we determine the topic of the race, and then we let people come with proposals and compete, and also collaborate. And typically this starts, as you see that, with the broad spectrum antivirals, 9 teams that then in phase 2 is dribbled down to 6 teams, and then it's 4 teams. And the money that each of the teams get goes up. So it's an inverse funnel. I'll give you a little bit of data because there is one stunning statistic coming with these sprint challenges. They are extremely fast. You see the last one, the composite learning, was just brought up. We'll start next year. This is a response to the observation that in Europe, we don't have the massive collection of data, copyrighted or not, right, that we can use for learning in our large language models. We have a few LLMs, but we don't have the data. Our data is dispersed. But there are technologies that allow us to do federated learning across dispersed data and text corpora. So this is a competition. And it will is planned to start with 9 teams, down to 6 teams, down to 4 teams, again, over roughly 2.5 years. Intellectual property is not claimed by the agency. It is left to the startups or the teams that are in there. Team composition is international. Anybody from the European research area can come. And the people can be anywhere in the world if they work in their teams. And the teams are very international, by the way. There's staging, okay? So the challenge, this is direct text from a first challenge. Challenge went on for 3 years. It's divided into 3 stages, 11 teams, 6 teams, and so forth. And the juries, I hope, profile. I brought you here the names in the jury of the carbon to value challenge. That was a challenge that said, hey, how can we turn carbon dioxide into something that has value, that we can sell in the market in order to address our most almost threatening challenge right now, that of warming of our planet, right? And you may know some of these people. They are experts in the field. Sorry for the table. But the table has one very, very decisive advantage that I can show you. So these are the challenges. You see what the maximum financing in round one was. You see the number of applicants. The most stunning thing is the duration. How long it took from the deadline for the submission of applications to paying out money the first time. This is in days. This is not in weeks. I can tell you that entrepreneurial teams, that scientists react extremely positive on this news. There's also a communication component. You have to talk to these folks. You have to energize them. And I don't have the time to go into that, but we got a lot of, despite of the fact that maybe sometimes my country is a little bit dodgy and not so amusing and prone to use humor and other things, we got quite a number of people to sort of go to the engineers, go to the inventors, energize them, get them to participate. What are the critical issues that have come up? One critical issue is, of course, that in 2016 it was clear this had to be a civilian agency, because in Germany it would never have gotten through parliament if it had military component. Now after Zeitenwende, things are different, but we need to discuss that. It was very clear from the beginning that if we had used an incrementally acting agency and put a radical aspect to it, we would have come up at something that would have been mediocre. That doesn't work. We need new organizations off the beaten path. We know that risk is high. It's roughly the risk that we have in venture capital portfolios, right? 20% of the remaining ones carry 80% of the total value in the portfolio. Some people say it's 10-90, whatever. Explain that to a Rechnungshof, to a controller general, who just counts the 80% versus the 20% and says the failure rate is dismal. Agency has failed. So we need other ways of communicating that to our parliaments and to our classical bodies. Then, of course, there is this issue that we need to select the people and then trust them. We need to give them leeway so that they can do what they are able to do. And that sometimes means that we need to relax rules regarding budget rollovers or the parliamentary overview. There's a tricky issue in the collaboration with public research organizations and universities. So Sprint funded a project, IP3.0, that seeks to establish standards, what the maximum should be that a university gets for the release of the patents of the IP that flows into the startups. And then there are time limitations. This is borrowed from DARPA, of course, right? People should not be in office more than 5 years in these agencies, because otherwise they build empires. So we have gotten this off in Germany. We have an EIC now. By the way, last Friday at the Falling Walls, the EIC team met the Sprint team and so forth. There's lots of communication and collaboration already in planning. By the way, Sprint has a French member in their team, which comes from Paris and is engaged in the French activities. So there's collaboration there. We know we need to work together to make this work for Europe. How do we do that? EIC needs better funding, that's very clear. EIC needs an ARPA component, this active component, the challenge component that I just described to you, which we have in Sprint. And then probably the national agencies will be the feed-in institutions upon which then EIC sets up its efforts and comes in with tremendous financial firepower, because it has more firepower and it is not under state aid rule. That's the big advantage. All of the national agencies have to abide by state aid rules. Okay, and then there's international collaboration, of course, with ARIA, the UK agency, and others. There's international collaboration, by the way, with the National Science Foundation, which Antonin mentioned already. The National Science Foundation came to the five-year anniversary celebration of Sprint 3 weeks ago, signed a memorandum of understanding, because the National Science Foundation, as a science funder in the United States, is now setting up a directorate for innovation and transfer, and they are interested in the mechanisms. By the way, I wish that all national European funding agencies, for example in my country, would set up something like that and give transfer a little bit more emphasis in what they do. All of this is very important, and it has become more important since last week. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dietmar. Thank you very much. Next is Natacha Valla, doyenne de l'École de Management et d'Innovation, Sciences Po Paris. Donc, Natacha.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really honored to be here because President Draghi is my president by heart. I'm a central banker by career, and thanks to him, I went back to Frankfurt at the time when we thought we would tighten monetary policy, but we ended up loosening it for another decade. And I have to say, this report that came out in the past few weeks was honey for us at the National Productivity Board, which I'm honored to preside. because the national productivity boards of the member states of the monetary union, you have to know that it was the initiative of a report back then which was called the Five Presidents Report, which was looking already at competitiveness, at productivity, but in a context that was really, really different from what we know today, in particular in the European context, where Germany had a strong surplus, countries like France had a strong deficit, we had issues related to relative unit labor costs. We were all looking at the same charts, diverging charts of relative unit labor costs. And things have changed a lot because the things we look at right now are more related to what we can do in common to become collectively more competitive. What are the relative advantages, but how can we pool them? So we read this with a lot of interest. And so today, when we prepared the session, we had Philippe gave the overarching view of the key elements for competitiveness today in Europe. We also had the detailed picture of where the productivity weaknesses in Europe on the slowdown of productivity came from. We have the recipe of how to create a DARPA in Europe, which is a real life example, and I think that's really encouraging. So I thought I would focus more on some elements for an industrial policy and the role of education in this. Those elements will be featured in some way in the forthcoming report, annual report of the National Productivity Board. It's not published yet, but I think some elements will be part of it. So I will say three things, basically. The first one is that the strategy we can have in mind for industrial policy. Remember, a few years ago, industrial policy was a gros mot. We were not able to mention it. It was something that we were not allowed to think of in terms of economic policy and in terms of possible strategy. And that has changed very deeply. So industrial policy, what are the options? And what are the pros and cons, and what is possibly the most favored way. Second set of elements on the role of education for a proper and successful education policy. And then finally, how to finance it. Some elements were mentioned, but I think the landscape, in particular the fact that the bank-based financed ecosystem being diversifying itself, that creates new opportunities. Perhaps also new challenges, but opportunities to create financing for scale-ups and for innovation in the European context. So starting with the strategies of industrial policies, I think that was clear from President Draghi's report, there's a spectrum, right? And there could be one extremity of the spectrum which is related to a fully fledged, you know, strategic autonomy, the pure prototype of something that would, you know, protect us from developments and uncertainties in the global economy. I think this is a bit of an ideal tip, which is not so realistic. And the other two options are one, focusing financing on a couple of key sectors, strategic sectors, and I think that's the sense of the remarks by Philippe Aguillon earlier, the fact that we're able to pool resources to support the sectors that we want to focus on. So I would say that would be a preferred model where the advantages are relatively clear. We are able to scale, to concentrate resources. Remember, Europe is big, but it's as big as it gets. In particular, when you compare the size of its economy with the equity valuation of the big players in the innovation sector. On this, we're also able now to have, and we've seen that with Antonin's facts, we're able to have a more granular analysis of where the low-hanging fruits in terms of productivity lie. We are looking at this at the National Productivity Board, and some we are able to identify the branches and the sectors that are a drag on productivity. We also are able to identify the reasons why, and Banque de France has published very good analysis on this, but the sectors that, for example, in these countries, those are retail trade, those are construction, services in real estate, when you sum them up, that's quite a big chunk of GDP. So it gives you an idea of where, if you want to boost productivity and channel financing even beyond the long-term impacts on innovation and potential growth. For short-term reasoning, there's a way to fix things and kickstart the engine. And the other dimension advantage of such a strategy is indeed the speed of impact on productivity and therefore on competitiveness, and also the fact that we would be able to create leaders, global leaders that are able to compete on the global scene. Of course, you also want probably to create some resilience in global value chains. We've seen that some shocks were really unexpected, and you might have to end up in a sort of second best realistic environment. And this is the more risk management aspect of industrial policy, is right. Even if the first best would be to focus on those productive sectors, those sectors at the frontier, for risk management purposes, you may want to put some of your, means in, I'm not saying in financing, in making sure that Doliprane is produced in France, but perhaps a little bit of it still, and therefore to secure the value chains, to reduce the vulnerabilities. And on this, we can use a degree of flexibility. Again, we're looking at this for the upcoming reports at the National Productivity Board, and we see that things, we can be a bit opportunistic on this as well, right? The global landscape, market shares in global trade are changing. The role of China, the place of China is declining. Within the monetary union, the relative position of economies are changing. Mind you, France is becoming again price competitive. On some sectors, and those sectors being industry and manufacturing. So price competitive relative to Germany, that's a bit of a scoop, and that creates some room for opportunities. Now, the recommendations that stem from this analysis are fairly straightforward. So I think I'd move now to the link between the industrial policies and the role of education. And here again, I think only by browsing the literature, recent and less recent, brings out a number of key sort of stylized facts, right? I'll list them, I have four or five of them. One, human capital is a driver of productivity. The OECD does an exercise of simulating the impact of an improvement of a country's PISA results. You know, the PISA results are the ranking of a country in terms of literacy and numeracy, the skills of our kids, basically. And if France were to become at pair with the 10 best countries, productivity would go up by 2.7%. So I mean, there's a number of analyses like this. So this is sort of a known fact, but also vindicated by the numbers. The skills level is also very strongly correlated by productivity. This is beneficial to value added by our work, but also beneficial to the individual in terms of career trajectory, in terms of the quality of the jobs that are available to workers, etc. General education, we speak a lot about innovation, the frontier, science, STEM areas, but general education is also an area which we should not undercover and underestimate. And finally, soft skills, and we produced that in our report last year, the role of soft skills and management skills, that was mentioned a little bit in the case of Germany, that matters, and that matters also for the ability of firms to innovate and for the productivity growth at the firm level. This is something we document with survey-based analysis, but this is fairly robust. So here again, the recommendations for education policy with respect to the desirability for industrial policy are fairly straightforward. Focus on literacy and numeracy. Focus in particular for innovative sectors on what we call STEM in France, right? Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Lifelong education, that's also an element. I mean, if we drop this, and I have to deal with it every day at Sciences Po, we have to think in one side of our brain about, you know, the education that we give to students who just got their A level, but then we have to think about the education that we give to professionals. But they connect all the time, and they will connect more and more. And professionals mean what? 5 years of professional experience? 10? 20? So we have to think of it as a continuum. I think institutionally that's not going to be easy, but as an impact in terms of accessibility and flexibility of access to the education system will help a heck of a lot in terms of being successful. I'll shift to my last point, which is the financing of industrial policies. What we see, and that is very well documented in President Draghi's report, private savings is abundant in Europe. It's unfortunately invested in not so low yielding, but a bit higher than before, but still relatively low yielding fixed income instruments issued by the US. It would be better employed in Europe on productive areas. The non-bank financing, and this is something that is less observed, directly observed, but you know, there's been an increase in private debt instruments, an increase in private equity, the broad place of private equity. And this is becoming more and more polarized. This is growing fast, but becoming more and more polarized. On the one hand, on large tickets, they want to finance big firms. They don't want to finance those weird in-between growth in the growth scale-up firms, or they want to go retail. So they want to get the money of retail investors, mainly households, exploiting in that way the sort of regulatory loopholes that we have on those actors. So that means, you know, as a direct way to allocate saving, it's not going to be directly invested in the areas that need financing the most. So as a recommendation for the financing, and this relates very directly to what is in President Draghi's report, and I have six recommendations and I will stop here. One, of course, having a common debt in Europe is something that could be very desirable, even if politically that's difficult. A more consensual element would be to adapt the mandate of national promotional banks, the EIB, the EIF, the EBRD, the Banque du Conseil de l'Europe. There are many institutions that have a AAA issuance and that would be able to, should be able to allocate funds better according to the thinking around an industrial policy. We could put in place systems of guarantees, first loss pieces, things that don't eat so much capital on the side of public finances. I think those recipes have been thought of to finance innovation in the past, but you know, organized around a common view on industrial policy would be very powerful. A sovereign fund in Europe would be obviously another options, and public private partnerships for infrastructure are also a valid option. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup, Natacha. Donc, j'invite Mathias de Watripon. Mathias est professeur à l'Université libre de Bruxelles. Et donc, ça, voilà. Donc, Mathias, floor is yours.
Well, hello. Thanks a lot for this invitation to this wonderful event in this prestigious place and to discuss a wonderful report. So, Philippe suggested that I focus on one important sector of the economy and discuss the relevance of the Draghi report here. And this is what I will do. So talk about pharma. Now, as you know, of course, pharma is a key market in the economy, in size, fourth largest in the world in terms of net sales, in terms of gross domestic product, 5% of EU value added to the economy from all manufacturing, in terms of employment, In the EU, almost 1 million people directly employed by the sector last year, up for a bit less than 700,000 in 2008, so 15 years before. And of course, it's a sector of geostrategic importance. Think of COVID vaccines, so it's important. Now, some pieces of good news. In contrast to big tech, where we look a bit pathetic in comparison to the US and gradually China, the EU is much stronger these days in this sector in terms of net exports, in terms of manufacturing base for medicines under patent, in terms of top publication. So that is good. However, the trend is less good. And as the report documents, the EU is falling behind in the most dynamic segments of the market. Biologicals, which is indeed a market that has grown in terms of sales by 150% from 2012 to 2022. Which is three times the total market growth, which has only been 50%. And also in the orphan medicines case, where sales have been multiplied by 24 in that same period. And also on medicines based on genes, tissues, and cells, advanced therapy medicinal products, categories which often overlap. So We should not, as I say, we are strong globally, but in those segments we should worry. And the problems are a bit the same as those identified in general by the report. And let me even put aside the AI challenge, because of course AI is not an area where we excel compared to the US. And you know, at some point, there was a world leader in mobile telephones, and it was called Nokia, and then Apple came. And you know, there is a car industry, which is not bad in Europe, and then Tesla came. And so, you know, precision medicine and AI helped medicine is something that's coming to us. The report does not stress that as much, but it's an additional challenge. But the other challenges are there too. And the causes, well, as in general, public R&D is in that sector lower than the US, but much more fragmented. Max Planck is very good, but he's only German. Inserm is very good, but he's only French. Then you have the lesser private R&D investment, listed and even more private equity, and a weaker supporting environment. We have zones of excellence here. However, they have bigger hubs in the US and China. You know, in the US, the Boston area, San Francisco area, I mean, we could do better here. And finally, a slow and complex EU regulatory framework. Now we have the EMA, which mirrors the Food and Drug Administration, so that's okay. But health technology assessments are national, pricing and reimbursement are national, and the health data space is too fragmented. Now, by the way, let me not, because we start talking about reimbursement, pricing, all this, let me not say that the US is doing things right on health. Huh? The US is a disaster in health overall, in terms of overall spending and in terms of aggregate statistics. Just read the great book by Ann Case and Angus Deaton, Death of Despair. So there are lots of things that are not doing well in a number of areas. In particular, they don't have universal healthcare. They have awful child mortality, infant mortality, and all these kind of things. However, on issues like R&D, they are to be emulated. And so the recommendation of the report, with which I think we can only agree, you want an EU health technology assessment agency, you want increased and focused EU public R&D investment, you want more world-class innovation hubs. Basically, the suggestion here echo the general idea of the report of massive public and private investment in fundamental research and disruptive technologies, supported by reforms to EU governance aimed at streamlining decision-making and putting scientists and entrepreneurs in charge to allow for the emergence of promising innovators. Now, let me give you as example the COVID-19 vaccine episode and see how that compares to the recommendation of the report. Successful vaccination requires a number of things: R&D, authorization, production, purchases, delivery, and persuasion. As people say, vaccines don't save lives, vaccination does. So there are lots of things. Let me just focus here mostly on today's topic, which is R&D, and then say a little word about purchases. On R&D, vaccines, and again, the Trump administration has done many things poorly on COVID management, including suggesting bleach and stuff like that. However, on R&D again, wow. Now, as was said, the US has a very impressive ecosystem, research universities, National Institute of Health, the ARPA Health, which was then called the BARDA, Biomedical Applied Research and Development Authority, biotechs with very effective financial markets, and big pharma companies. Moreover, they managed to centralize the operation thanks to Operation Warp Speed. They went to find talent where it was, and in particular, the chief scientific officer was Monsef Slaoui, who is a Moroccan citizen and Belgian citizen because he studied in my university before going to GSK. They used the Defense Production Act, the US Army. We don't have these things in Europe. The way they did it, and this is where I think it's key, and by the way, I was also very impressed by Dietmar's presentation of Sprint, so I think I think we are talking about the same model. Huh? One thing what BARDA did, they allocated a lot of money. That's the key in the US. They have US money. We have little EU money. We have national money. So for these kinds of world challenges, it was good to say, okay, and asking indeed the people with the right skills to make the choices, they decided to fund mostly 6 projects. By the way, this is coming from work we did with Philippe and with Sofia Amaral Garcia and Michel Goldman, the founder of our Institute for Interdisciplinary Innovation in Healthcare. So basically, they allocated between $1 and $2 billion to 6 projects, 3 technologies, mRNA, well-known, viral vector protein subunit. Each time, 2 projects, 1 US and 1 EU project. So mRNA was Moderna, but also BioNTech, which is a German firm, that then teamed up for production later on with Pfizer, but it was the BioNTech. You know, people in vaccine, they don't talk about the Pfizer vaccine, they talk about the BioNTech vaccine. Then, for the second technology, Johnson & Johnson US, Oxford, AstraZeneca, UK, Sweden, and then the third one, Novavax, a small company, and then 2 big firms from Europe, Sanofi and GSK. In the end, in record time, all 6 projects have been authorized either in the EU or in the US or in both. So you often talk about industrial policy not being able to pick winners. Well, this is, if you want an exception, that's one. Huh? They were amazingly good. huge success of industrial policy, but they did diversify again, as Dietmar said. And look at the contrast. They didn't ask the leaders pre-COVID to come around the table. The top firms before were GSK, Sanofi, Merck Sharp & Dohme in the US, and Pfizer. They didn't ask these four firms to do it. They diversified, and the winners in the end, mRNA technology was the best, they were biotech firms, Moderna in the US and BioNTech in Germany. So I think, and you know, all these GAFAMs, they did not exist 40 years ago, 50 years ago. So this is very important to go for new firms. So we have strengths too, but we need more cooperation to emulate the NIH. Again, as was said by Philippe, the EU is a regulatory giant, but a budgetary dwarf. We have to change that, and it's a key of the Draghi report recommendation. We need to set up an EU BARDA. The Health Emergency and Reaction Authority and Response Authority is a beginning of that, but only a beginning. And of course, we could do more. We need more Europe, and that's, I think, really key. Then, by the way, an additional thing which is not in the report, and I would add to the as a recommendation probably, is in terms of purchases, the EU also innovated in terms of having joint purchases of these vaccines. Because, you know, these big firms, they are after money, and that's their business. They are after money. So the highest price wins. So Israel got the vaccines first, not because they were involved in R&D, not because they were involved in production, just they paid more. The EU, in the beginning, you had four countries, Germany, France, Italy, and the Netherlands, trying together to get priority access to the vaccines. Now, as a Belgian citizen, I'm quite happy that Commission President von der Leyen managed to go for joint purchases for everybody and achieve, therefore, intra-EU equity, and moreover, at reasonably low prices. And so in that sense, I think centralization is useful to counter pharma companies' attempt to play countries against one another. So we do need to have more Europe here too. I think that some bargaining power is important on our side, because basically, as I try to argue here, so the COVID vaccine innovation fully validates the conclusion of the Draghi report and the importance of BARDA, ARPA health style institution, Sprint, but at EU level, not only Germany, at EU level. And it's a useful complement to have joint procurement because, let's face it, all this money that the Draghi report is suggesting to add at EU level, which of course could come from national level, but that won't be easy. But let's face it, we are in a world where we need to control public expenditures, which are under stress, given the combined cost of aging, defense, and the digital and environmental transition. Therefore, together, in fact, with Michel Goldman and with Alain Fischer, who was a professor here, who was Mr. Vaccination under COVID, and who is one of the fathers of gene therapies, we argue that it is a good idea to not only have more centralization in public R&D, in pharma, and the organization of clinical trials. It's also a good idea to go for these joint procurement for these rare diseases whose budgets are completely exploding, as was argued in the Draghi report. So thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.